Chapter 40. As she'd arranged, Caris was still at her dawn prayers when Promarchos Andros Gyle arrived. She lay prostrate before the open window facing the sun and felt the faint stirring of the wind as the inner door opened behind her.
Orholm, she pleaded aloud, I could try to hide my ignorance, but I won't. I'm not going to act in darkness. Let it all stand before the light. Orholm, this is your empire. These are your people. You will have to fight for us, or we shall perish. Will you let your name be defamed upon the earth?
She stayed there prone for some time, praying. She'd arranged this, but that didn't mean it wasn't real, too. She needed to look like a zealot in order to accomplish what needed doing. It was the zealots in the magisterium who could give her the most trouble if they allied against her, but by disarming them, she could also make unnecessary the calls for Luxors. She had two Luxors. She had no desire for there to be any more, by her hand or any other. But as she said the words for Andros Gyle's benefit, let him think her a little crazy, it might make him careful around her, she realized she meant them too. She wasn't fighting for herself. She didn't want power for its own sake. She wanted only to save the Chromeria and the people of the Seven Satrapies. After that was accomplished, she would happily step down. So it was only right that Orholm should take up his own fight. This war was his problem. Finally, when she felt emptied, when she felt heard, she stirred. She hadn't realized that Andros Gyle had gotten down on his face next to her.
A prayer as fierce as you are, Andros said, dusting his hands off.
My apologies for keeping you waiting, she said.
One must know the order of one's loyalties, Andros said,
as if understanding her perfectly.
But Orholm knows the heart. Our prayers are surely for our own reflection more than for his instruction, no?
A point for the Luxiats to debate, no doubt. Tea,
he gestured to her slave to close the doors to the balcony. It was a breach of etiquette for him to command her slaves, but a small one. He obviously thought she deserved it for keeping him waiting.
We have much to discuss, but before we get started, Caris said.
She chewed on her lower lip, thinking.
A number of months ago, I was ambushed on Big Jasper. I was beaten, efficiently and dispassionately. It was clearly intended to teach me a lesson. Maybe a man would have taken such a beating as intended. Once he realized he wasn't being beaten to death, he might simply endure it.
Perhaps.
But a woman made to feel utterly helpless, at the hands of half a dozen men? She paused. There are different fears. Lingering fears. Fears that can be crippling if one doesn't know her history.
Perhaps that was the message instead. A beating is bad, but there are worse things possible,
Andros said innocently, as if just speculating, trying to find the answer with her.
If so, she said, that message was beyond ill-considered and had the opposite effect to what was intended. No one likes to feel helpless. I have a particular loathing for it. I made a foolish oath about what I would do when I found out who had done that to me. It involved flaying and honey and insects and castration. Not a fitting oath for the white to take.
But then you weren't the white at the time, he said,
still so damnably innocent.
No, indeed. Do you think a white is bound by oaths she made before she was the white?
Yes. Unless they interfere with her duties as the white. That oath and office supersedes all lower bonds, Andros said.
I agree. It becomes tricky, though. You see, with all the intelligence apparatus available to me as the white, I've uncovered who ordered my beating.
Indeed,
he asked.
A curious allocation of your resources. Don't you think? Still, I wish I had thought to have my own people look into that for you. What punishment may I help you inflict upon this malefactor?
She took a breath and looked away. None. I forgive you.
Me? Beg your pardon?
He didn't even sound that outraged. He wasn't even trying.
I seek no vengeance against you. I consider the matter closed.
Note. Baffle Andros Gyle. Check.
In return for what? Me admitting something I obviously didn't do? Andros asked.
But his expression had already betrayed him.
It would be nice.
My dear, some people only know the language of blunt objects. I speak to such people in the language they understand. You, however, are not one of those.
She held up a hand. I forgive you. Let it not stand between us. Clean slate.
Generous of you,
he said sarcastically.
Should I forgive you in turn for seducing my sons and destroying the 7 satrapies?
It was so unfair, it almost took her breath. Andros Gyle had been the one who ordered his younger son Dazen to seduce Caris, so that he wouldn't have to marry off his elder son to her to seal their family's alliance. It had worked, too. She and Dazen had fallen in love. But then the real Gavin couldn't bear to see his younger brother so happy. What happened next was Andros Gyle's fault more than anyone's, and he blamed her, a 15-year-old girl at the time. She wanted to scratch his damn eyes out, but she'd learned something in the archers about fighting those who were bigger and stronger, things about accounting for the trajectory of the superior force. You never try to stop it. You redirect it instead. Yes, please do forgive me, she said, without a hint of sarcasm. He stopped, suddenly emotionless. He wasn't often taken by surprise.
Oh, I don't think I respected Aurea enough, he said finally.
She wasn't sure which he meant, that Aurea had been brilliant in appointing Caris, who was so surprisingly capable, or that it had been nice to deal with Aurea, and he hadn't noticed how nice until he had to deal with her inferior. A mistake I'm sure you'll not make with her successor, Caris said. He chuckled.
Oh, I already have. But not again, perhaps. I make many mistakes, but few of them twice.
Well, now that we've gotten all that out of the way, the purpose of our meeting, Caris said.
Yes, pray tell,
Caris said. I looked at the faces of all the Hyluxiates and the colours on the execution platform when that thing happened. I saw bewilderment or fear on every face. Most hiding it, naturally. But one face looked almost... She paused. Andros said,
Please don't hold back on my account.
Smug. Like he'd been proven right about something. Strange, don't you think?
That would be an odd expression for such a time, Andros agreed. And quite astute of you to look for it.
He sipped his tea. I think you might find that my eye is on you more than you'd guess, Caris said. Shit, that came out as a threat. To see how I should act, to take your lead.
To take my lead? He asked, amused.
She wanted to kill him. She wanted justice for Aurea's murder. She wanted to demand to know what he'd done with Mauricia and the package of letters. But that was all a fantasy. Andros Gyle was too dangerous to kill. He was also too valuable alive. When he wanted things done, he got them done, and diplomats who might start fights with anyone else would do anything in their power not to tangle with Andros Gyle. Which mattered. This war wasn't just going to fizzle out. Caris saw that now. The White King was making smart moves in his conquered lands, preparing to hold and keep them, to generate wealth that he could draw from to take all the satrapies. Vengeance is yours, Aura Holum. It'll have to be. Promarchos, Caris said. When you lock shields with the man next to you in a battle line, you don't first ask his opinion on the Manichaean dichotomy. I don't intend to challenge your position or your power so long as I feel we're fighting on the same side. The Colour Prince has gone from a regional problem to an existential crisis. I can't fight you and him at the same time. But if I need to fight you before the satrapies can fight him, I'll throw everything against you, and I will fight you until one of us is annihilated. I can't do half measures, and I won't accept them from you. So, war. Together. Are you in or out? And this was where it was important to see her as a zealot.
In,
he said it with no hesitation. Then start talking. What happened at the execution? What was that thing? Why haven't I heard about any of this before? Caris hadn't slept well since the execution. She didn't know if she'd ever sleep well again. Seeing that monster tear out of that spy's skin had been the single most frightening experience of her life. In all her battles, even hunting down whites, those she'd fought had been men at core. This was something else. For the first time Caris had ever seen, Andros Gyle looked somewhat daunted, as if he didn't know what to say, or perhaps where to start.
Have you heard of the Thousand Worlds.
I'm not interested in fairy stories, Karis wanted to say, but Andros Gael rarely went on tangents without good reason. The premise that there are many worlds like ours?
Not exactly like ours, Andros said. The idea being that Aurholam, being a creator, wouldn't necessarily stop after making one world. Maybe he'd make 20, or 1,000, or 1,000,000, who knows? I was ambivalent about the hypothesis. The unmasking of Nabiros has changed my thinking.
That thing. Dalara Orange swore it wasn't a will casting or a hex.
I believe her. Nabiros was real.
He rested his piercing eyes on her.
The Chromeria and the Magisterium don't actually teach some of the things that they believe, for fear that weaker souls will be led astray. Regardless, I've been piecing together truths and making leaps of intuition for many years, but this is the truth as well as I know. Will you cry heresy if I say things you don't like?
It wasn't a real question. What it was, Karis saw, was a plea to have his efforts recognized. Doubtless, Felia had always given him assurances of his genius, but the old man's wife was gone now, and he wanted someone to appreciate his intellectual heavy lifting. So instead of mocking him as her heart desired, Karis chose compassion. He'd lost his wife, for Aurholam's sake. Be kind. By the grace of Aurholam alone, she painted rapt attention on her features. Caveats accepted. What have you learned? He stared hard at her, looking for mockery, and here she saw him as human again, with weaknesses, seeking approval and praise, not venally, but simply as part of the normal human exchange. A person does something excellent and useful, and they wish it to be recognized. But then he accepted her interest and took it as his due, the momentary chink in his arrogance covered again.
It was told to me as a creation story, transcribed from an old Tiru wise man in the Parian Highlands, but I've no gift for stories. Mine is a mind that tears things asunder and examines the pieces. What matters for us is that before time, Aurholam created 600 immortals, or possibly 600 legions, but let's not complicate things. 200 of those rejected him and sought his throne. They lost, are losing, will lose. In the meantime, they seek to ruin every joy Aurholam might have of his creations, and taste every dark pleasure they may. If they may not rule all the celestial realms, they desire to rule a world. They will possess the bodies of the willing to taste what it is like to wear flesh. They will sire children. They will murder, steal, crush, and rape. They will defile any goodness they find. They will wage war and bring ruin wherever they can, in their fury at losing the home that was free to them, and is now forbidden forever, for rage burns hottest against a punishment deserved.
That was nothing new, except for the specificity of the numbers. What was new was Andros's treating it as real. Karis had to guess there was some spin into heresy coming soon.
The salient fact, though, is that these immortals are neither omniscient nor omnipresent. Here.
He reached into his pockets and pulled out a number of short scrolls, one after the other. Karis could commiserate. They were both always getting reports, and always on scrolls of uniform size, which made them stack better, but also led to the waste of having entire sheets of lambskin with only the words "arrived safely," or something similarly concise on them. Many of the reports were deemed too sensitive for the parchments to be scraped and reused, too. He unrolled half a dozen scrolls and laid them atop each other on Karis's desk.
Imagine this scroll is the history of our world, beginning here to end over here. This one, another world's history, and another's.
Andros stacked the papers and drew his belt knife. He laid the point against the skin.
We experience time like this.
He dragged the knife lightly forward.
An immortal, on the other hand, may enter any world of its choosing.
He flipped a different scroll onto the top of the pile.
It may enter at any location it desires, any kingdom, satrapy, or city.
He moved the knife left and right.
But once it enters, it moves in time as we do until it leaves.
He stabbed the knife all the way through all of the scrolls.
They aren't omnipresent, so if they choose to be in Ru all Sunday, they may not ever be in Tyria on the same day.
He grabbed a quill, dipped it, and crossed out everything to the left and right of the point where the knife had stabbed. Then he cut forward. Then he lifted the knife out of the skins.
So if our immortal stays a year in Ru, say, being worshipped as the goddess Atarat, that is a year denied her elsewhere.
With the quill he crossed out all the area left and right of his cut.
But why the stack? Caris asked.
Because there are many worlds, but only one time.
He flipped a different scroll onto the top of the stack. He crossed out the entire area left and right of the cut, there too.
So Atarat is denied that time everywhere else. An immortal has all eternity, but they have only a finite number of chances to interact with us mortals. Thus, paradoxically, with all eternity available to them, a single day becomes incredibly precious to immortals. So were I immortal, I would only visit when my presence would matter most. Perhaps on my holy days, or more likely in times of war, where I might claim or lose an entire world.
Caris did not like where this was suddenly going. Tingles prickled along her skin. An immortal like Nabiros? Andros looked at her and licked dry lips. She swore she saw a flicker of fear in his eyes.
We've entered a time that immortals find interesting enough to visit personally. And because of some fluke, or perhaps some very carefully prescribed and maintained traditions that neither you nor I were aware of, we have just done exactly what we needed to do to kill one of them. I think it will be an insane level of optimism not to expect the full fury of their vengeance.
It was as if the floor had dropped out from under her. Caris's problems had looked daunting when they'd been human. She buried her face in her hands and felt her gorge rising. It was too much for her. She was the wrong person for all this. She was going to fail everyone, and now that failure wouldn't just mean the dissolution of the kingdom.
Breathe, Caris.
She pulled herself together and suddenly thought of something.
We aren't alone in this. This is Orholm's fight. We didn't kill Nabiros by sheer luck. Those traditions weren't just stumbled upon. Someone taught our ancestors those, and that we followed them well enough that they worked? That wasn't luck. It must have been Orholm's immortals intervening on our side.
And suddenly she could breathe again. Things were harmoniously blue and orderly again. Orholm would take care of the immortals, and she'd take care of her lists. That made sense. Then Andros shit all over her piece, as he did.
Let us not mistake their side and ours. This is one battlefield among 100,000 for them. Perhaps their victory is complete now that one of the 200 rebels is banished. Or perhaps by drawing the vengeance of his fellows, they get a dozen of the rebels to waste days or even mere hours here that are critically important to a battle on some other world that they believe is more important.
You're telling me we could just be a distraction? Caris asked.
How did the old story put it? When the king sends a ship of grain to his ally, he worries not about the comfort of the rats in the hold. Our lives are nothing to the universe, High Lady.
This is where your great intellect fails you for a lack of imagination and faith, Androsgar. You think that to be concerned with the great tides of history means that one must lose track of one little fish, or that by caring for one son you cannot care equally for another.
You wish to compare how well we have loved our sons? Andros asked.
I didn't mean it like that, she said, flushing. She didn't want to talk about Zymon.
He made her uncomfortable still, though that was surely her own guilt speaking. But he was always touching her, always wanting to be with her.
I meant that Orholm sees and hears and cares and...
And saves. Yes, I know the old prayer. I'm simply not convinced by it. Tell me, Caris, have you ever prayed for something that you thought you needed more than breath itself?
Gavin is still missing. How dare you ask me that?
Ah, Gavin, yes. A man of singular gifts, indeed. A man who would be of immense help in this war of ours, wouldn't he?
She said nothing. Certain some cruelty would come out of Andros Gile's mouth next.
And where is he? And where is the Orholm who saves, who sees, who cares?
Caris had no answer.
We're in a battle alone, and of the immortals, only one side has shown up, and it wasn't Orholm's.
What would you have us do? Caris said.
First, understand the stakes. We aren't only fighting rebels now. We fight against the gods themselves. Should they win, this whole world will fall into their hands, perhaps until the end of time. We've killed one. In his time, Lucidonius killed 9. Depending on which translation is correct, that leaves us to face either 1,200,000 minus 10, or 190. The good news or bad is that they come in ranks. Naboros or Cerberus is a low-ranking immortal.
Naturally, Caris said. Holy shit.
I don't know what happens if the strongest ones come. It was said during the reign of one particularly old and powerful Atarat that it was impossible to draft Green anywhere in Blood Forest without his permission. Scholars since have interpreted that to mean drafting Green in Blood Forest was illegal. I think they really meant impossible.
Like what we felt at Rue, Caris said. At the end, Greens there had lost control of their bodies, been unable to move. The Greens felt the bane from many leagues away, but it was only crippling within, what, a league or two? But how do they do it, and what determines their power? Andros hesitated.
The point is—
No, wait. What was that? You were just going to say something. Tell me. Andros thought for a moment, studying her.
That's how they do what they do and what determines their power is what I sent Zaimund to find out. It's why I ordered him to infiltrate the Colour Prince's ranks. He didn't learn much, unfortunately, before he had to flee. He'd failed the Colour Prince twice, in assassinating Gavin and in holding Ruic Head. Truth is, I'm not entirely certain he meant to fail at either.
But Caris didn't even hear the last biting words. Of course Andros would try to soil her joy. Caris hadn't been able to get straight answers out of Zaimund about when he'd tried to hurt Gavin, she'd said, couching it gently. No wonder. His grandfather was to blame for all that. And he was trying to keep it secret because he was being loyal to Andros, the one person in his family he'd known for years. And Andros, the cold bastard, had put Zaimund in a place where he'd needed to publicly fail at an assassination attempt, but appear to really be trying, in order to obey his grandfather and keep his position near the Colour Prince. Note. Confront Zaimund about trying to assassinate Gavin and kill Kip. Scratch that. Thank Orholm.
The point is, Andros said, exasperated, perhaps Orholm sees us as an acceptable sacrifice in a greater war. I do not. High Lady, I wish you to pick up your knives. If we're to survive this, we must be harder and smarter and stronger and crueler than the gods themselves.
He regarded her for a long moment, and she shelved her sudden hope that maybe now things would feel more natural with Zaimund, now that those awful things were explained away. Andros said,
I ordered those men to beat you because I saw what Arrhea was doing, how she was grooming you, giving you all these different assignments so you could learn her work. And I didn't think you were equal to it. I remembered that snivelling girl you were, pretty and thoughtless. I wanted to see what you were made of, if you could even find out it was me, and if so, how you would come at me. I thought you were unwilling to fight back, or that when you did, you'd do it recklessly and stupidly. I was wrong about you then, and later too.
Later? You mean when you stacked the election to White against me? And tried to have me killed? She didn't say aloud.
You will need all your strength for this fight, he said, and that streak of insanity or faith you show, whether it's real or feigned.
To say she was baffled would have been understating the matter. Had he just admitted to trying to have her killed? What was that? Why? Perhaps it was as close to an apology as he was capable of. He got up and walked to the door. She simply stared after him, speechless.
Oh! He said, turning, in case it wasn't clear enough. Zaimund is one of my knives, sharp and imbalanced, but very predictable once you understand what he is. In normal times, I should not... But these are not normal times, are they? Let me offer you this. Guilt is a poor counselor. Guilt often conspires to make two victims where there was only one. If it comes to trusting your gut or trusting your son, make a wise choice, High Lady.